Welcome to Last Orders, the Spike podcast all about freedom and the nanny state. In this episode, we discuss woke indoctrination in schools, the incompetence of the WHO, and the perils of prohibitionism. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by Chris Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris.
Hey, Tom. Hello, listeners.
And we're delighted to be joined on the show today, first time on the show, by Alka Segal Cuthbert, who is the director of Don't Divide Us, which is the colourblind anti-racist campaign group. Alka, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Hello, thank you for inviting me.
So, Alka, we wanted to get you on to talk about your work at Don't Divide Us. In particular, I know that you've been doing a lot around education. So, as many people who've been paying attention will realise, there's been a lot of stories recently about external organisations coming into schools to preach a lot of these kind of woke precepts around white privilege, racial guilt, institutional racism, and so on. And I know that Don't Divide Us have really been at the forefront of this discussion with a report you brought out a few months ago about this kind of issue of what is essentially kind of indoctrinating rather than educating young people around issues of race in particular. I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what you and Don't Divide Us have found out that's been going on in Britain schools.
Thank you, Tom. Well, what we've found out is that there's a new subsection of the educational profession has developed, which are companies, charities, some kind of weird hybrids of schools that will group together in a local region and then make themselves into a company. They're delivering all kinds of services to schools, from IT services, professional development, but also equity, diversity and inclusion, content and training for both staff and for pupils as well. Now, the thing about this is that there are a few things about this. The first thing is that there is absolutely no oversight of these companies, right? Nobody from the DfE or the professional subject associations or the exam boards or the educational unions or local education authorities seem at all interested or seem to know very much about who they are, what they're actually doing, and whether what they're doing is actually fits in with, the more traditional liberal aims of education. So it has given activists a free kind of run, if you like, an entry into schools in a way that was denied to. I mean, if you're like a PhD student like I was, and you wanted to go into a school, you would have to do that much form filling of ethical things, and it would take a long time. But these are people who are charging to basically go into schools and provide them with the ethical security blanket that schools, for some reason, feel a pressure that they have to. Higher. Now, I don't think all schools are doing this necessarily, and it could well be that even if a school does bring in such a company, it doesn't mean that every single lesson is going to be woke, right? But that's not the point. The point is that this ideology has been officially legitimized, effectively, by all the major institutional, stops that should be checking, and at least raising some questions, have significantly failed to do so. So it's not blaming teachers so much. They're not the subject of the report. The subject of the report is the existence of these third-party organisations, their personnel. It's a very particular kind of layer of, if you like, professionals who are, peopling this sector, and the lack of oversight and the lack of accountability.
Alka, is there any kind of specific examples of maybe some of the lessons that are being taught, some of the workshops that these external organisations are doing? Could you give us a bit of a flavour for what these indoctrination sessions, if we're going to call them that, are like for the students?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think, in the aftermath of the Black Lives Matter protests in 2020, several parents sent in examples of school assemblies. These were from London schools that were just very, they were just explicitly pro Black Lives Matters, explicitly very, very activist orientated. But the thing is, a really surprising thing is, when I was researching for this second report, you know, it's very similar imagery of the fist, the upraised fist, references to the pyramid of white privilege, instructing teachers to tell pupils that they needed to be quiet to make space for their, black colleagues. You know, this was being promoted by the Church of England, Church of England Education Board. We have primary schools, I think just in Scotland just this week, a local authority in Ayrshire, I think, is, you know, under the auspices of promoting a literacy scheme, is recommending books like My Skin, Your Skin, which is aimed at primary school children. And, you know, it's just so explicitly re-racializing, telling kids to see color, telling children things that really aren't true, you know, like racism started a long time ago when white people wanted to show they were better than non-white people. I mean, in education, to endorse that kind of cavalier attitude to the truth is quite extraordinary, I think, because these aren't fiction books. You know, these are presented to be like ethical, PHSC pastoral type guidance.
And as you say, so it's that thing about, it's not as if this is just a discussion about some of the issues that are taking place. I mean, even though that would probably be quite inappropriate at quite a young level, which is where you see a lot of this happening, but it is very much being presented as fact, as you're sort of suggesting. This is just how it is, as far as they're concerned.
I mean, yes, you know, I mean, it is. I mean, it is quite, I mean, very early on, we could see that there was in some of the official discourse, it was quite explicit that the aim is to delegitimize a colorblind view, a colorblind approach to a universalist approach, which, you know, is the view that a lot of people in Britain still subscribe to. It refers to a set of ethics and beliefs and practices that have helped us make enormous progress. So to just delegitimize it with no reason, just to sort of ex cathedra declare it out of bounds, is extraordinarily authoritarian, you know, and it's very anti-educational. I mean, it's politically wrong, but it's also doesn't encourage the kind of open thinking and questioning that is central to a liberal education, you know.
And Chris, what have you made of all of this?
Well, I mean, the IA do quite a few schools talks. I've been going to Edinburgh and Gateshead this week to speak to students. We sort of do like a morning session about various different issues. We're not radicalising people. In fact, it's fairly vanilla, all the stuff we talk about generally. But, I mean, people might say, well, that's a third-party group getting involved in people's education. I don't know. Obviously, I'm very much opposed to the kind of agenda that we're talking about here. I just don't know what to do about it. Maybe one day we could get a conservative government could stop it. Perhaps, I don't know. My go-to solution for these things is always just to privatise a lot. So we could privatise all the schools, state schools. They don't do very well compared to private schools. So let's have them all private, give people schools vouchers and that. People have choices, and if schools want to have all this sort of carry on and the parents are aware of what's being taught, and that's another issue, is allowing parents to know what their kids are being taught, and that's been in the news a bit recently. And I don't, in principle, don't really have a problem with it, but I don't understand how these people are really getting in there and where they're getting the money from. You know, it seems very peculiar to me, and naturally it's going to largely depend on what you think of these people's agendas as to how opposed you are to them going to schools. I think most people would agree that it's quite good to have people popping into schools. I used to quite like it when I was at school and somebody would come in and talk to us about such and such. We had the people from Colgate in, I think, when I was at primary school. That was good. I've been a Colgate consumer ever since. I don't know if that's even legal anymore, but
so it works.
I was very young. At the time, Colgate had they used a Madness song to promote their products. Which one was it? Baggy Trousers, I think. that got me into madness as well. So it was a double bonus.
Double indoctrination.
So let's have more private companies going and selling stuff. That seems far more positive than having BLM people.
I mean, it's got to be a new record on this podcast for you calling to privatise something and your very first answer.
Yeah.
I don't think that would solve it, sorry, I'm afraid to say.
We probably wouldn't solve it, but it would be, maybe people would have the choice, you know, and if you've got some mad parent who wants their child to be indoctrinated with BLM stuff or what have you, then I'm not against them doing that. I'm not against schools teaching pretty much anything.
Well, I think it depends. The important thing about schools is that it depends whether they are teaching. I'm not against, I think you can teach about anything, but that about is very important because, you know, it's one thing to teach about Black Lives Matter or white privilege as, you know, a belief that belongs to a particular theoretical view of society. Although obviously, you know, you would not be doing that at primary school or even at secondary school because the ability to think abstractly is developmental. Kids aren't born with it. You know, it takes quite a long time to develop. But it would be sort of at the older ages. But that's not what we're talking about, though. We're not talking about teaching about something as if it were one knowledge claim among others and others are introduced. This is quite specifically introducing beliefs from critical social justice, whether they're around race, gender and sex, or the climate crisis, as they say, then and teaching them really in a way that will brook no opposition, because these beliefs are then being given moral value. You know, they're being given a higher moral status than any other beliefs. So to question it is not just to raise a skeptical stance towards a knowledge claim. It is, if you question it, you are seen as personally attacking the person, right? And you know, unfortunately, we do have a layer of educators and teacher trainers. I was in discussion on a panel very recently, and I only presented a different view, but that was enough to have the person, you know, howling that they were, you know, I had failed to validate her lived experiences. And you know, this is a trainer of teachers, so this is not inviting, you know, your local friendly, you know, fire station, you know, or your Bobby or your fireman or anything like that. This is quite an explicitly political project here.
It is. And I obviously basically agree with you, but just to play devil's advocate, we do have, you know, Catholic schools and church schools and indeed other religions where I assume they teach these religions as more or less facts.
But that's explicit as well, I suppose, because one thing that's been interesting is how, and you see this with the gender issue as well, how almost without anyone noticing, across the kind of state education sector, all of this stuff has just kind of washed in. You see very similar materials at a whole range of different schools. It seems to actually suggest alchemy in the training. And also, I'm not sure if this has been as explicit with the critical race theory kind of aspect of this, but certainly on the question of gender ideology, when you have had parents push back and say, I've seen this lesson plan, where did it come from? I want to see what's on the curriculum. You've often had that information being withheld from them, often on the grounds that it's intellectual property or something very strange. So I mean, is it not the case that in a sense, if you send your kid to a Catholic school, you know what you're getting, but if you send your kid to your average state school, they could well be being given this kind of information in a way that you don't know about, and they might even try to prevent you from finding out about potentially if it's...
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's true. Although I do assume, you know, if you send your child to a state school, as I do, that they will get indoctrinated by mad leftist propaganda. So I can sort of take that.
It's baked in for you at this point.
Yeah, it's baked in. Yeah. But you're going to have a lot of stupid lefty teachers filling their minds with rubbish and assume they get out the better. But no, in all seriousness, yes, it shouldn't be happening. I don't know how it is happening. It's presumably taxpayers' money ultimately keeping these people afloat because they're getting paid to come in, right? Unlike the local Bobby or the local toothpaste manufacturer, this is their business model, essentially, yeah?
Oh, yes, they are businesses, and a couple of them are very big. But I think, I mean, for me, it speaks to a much more profound problem, really, which no party is in a position to address, which is that, you know, nobody actually has a vision of what education should be, right? It's having spoken to some head teachers recently, you know, only a very small percentage of them were very committed to this social justice agenda. But what most of them felt was a kind of vague pressure to help children fit into society, you know, and society is seen as this terrible mess, you know, full of conflict and terrible political argumentation. And somehow they feel they have to kind of inoculate or protect their pupils, which is quite understandable. But what is absent from that is any sense that if they educated them properly, they would be doing something good for those pupils anyway, you know, and that society will always be conflictual to a greater or lesser extent. And it will be up to adults to debate what's right and wrong and what are the norms and so forth. And you know, it's a kind of like, I think it speaks to a real loss of faith in the intrinsic value of just educating children in knowledge that is not the same as everyday beliefs that you find in society, knowledge that has a stronger relationship to disciplinary knowledge. You know, that's the whole thing that helps children enter a world of ideas. It's a real form of intellectual freedom that's being denied, and it's being denied across the board, right and left, private schools and state schools.
And just briefly before we move on, Alka, when we're talking about intellectual freedom being denied, you got a bit of a direct taste of this yourself recently, where you were essentially no platform from this Rethinking Education conference. Do you want to tell us a little bit in a nutshell about what happened there? Because it's a very revealing case, I think.
Yes, it is. What happened was 2 days before I was due to speak on a panel at an educational conference. It's run by an educational company. And it's ironically, it was on indoctrination and impartiality in schools. I'm told by the chair, who is not the organizer, the chair was actually from the Education Forum, and he said, Alka, I'm really sorry, but you've been disinvited. And anyway, I investigated with the organizers. And, you know, the organizer, James Mannion, was really apologetic, very nice man. He sounded like a very nice man. But he said, seven people 2 nights before had got in touch with him to say how threatened they would feel by my presence there as somebody representing Don't Divide Us, which was quite extraordinary, you know, because he, you know, the organizer himself said, well, you know, it speaks to what I said just saying before about the lack of belief or understanding of education, because he said, oh, Alka, I've read your academic work, because I still do keep my finger in kind of every now and then. And, you know, he clearly liked what I said academically about literature and stuff. He said, but you know, I've seen these seven people in a Zoom meeting and they are genuinely distressed. So I've got to fulfill my safeguarding duties. And then when I pushed him on this a bit, he said, in between that, he then said, you know, the problem is not my academic work, but it's the Don't Divide Us, right? It's the beliefs of Don't Divide Us, which are essentially treat everybody as moral equals. We do not subscribe to the unproven belief that Britain is inherently a racist country, right? It isn't. That's just a lie.
Scary stuff indeed.
Yeah. Well, that scared them. And then he turned around and said, well, you know, we really believe in freedom of speech, but psychological safety is a precondition of freedom of speech, which I know where this comes from in terms of academic thinking. It's a pile of BS, to be honest, because that applies to a therapy room, you know, not to an educational setting and not between adults. So it was quite extraordinary, really. However, you know, he did, when we restaged it with the help of the Free Speech Union, he did say that he would, you know, sort of send the recording out to his, you know, his mailing list. So something was salvaged from it, but a telling episode, as you say.
Absolutely. Chris, shall we move on to some of the nanny state stories that you've picked out this week? Should we start with the World Health Organization, which has just had to cancel its conference in Panama for quite interesting reasons? It seems like there were protests going on there about a Canadian company being given licenses to mine copper or something. But as you've written about in your blog, this seems to be the WHO's inability to hold any conference at any time, anywhere almost. You want to tell us a little bit about this story?
Yeah, they get they're plagued by bad luck or karma, as some people might say. So this is the biannual conference they have for this, a bit of a mouthful, the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control Conference of the Parties, number 10. Number 9 was cancelled because of COVID. Number 8, I think, went off without a hitch in Geneva. That wasn't too bad. The one before that was in Delhi when they had the worst air pollution that Delhi ever had, which, as you can imagine, was quite bad. And all these anti-smoking campaigners came back with terrible coughs. Probably did the lungs more damage than a lifetime of smoking. And the one before that was in Moscow with Putin, you know, and that happened almost exactly the same time as the Ebola crisis unfolded. And there's suddenly a lot of pressure, quite rightly, on the WHO to do something about Ebola. And the Director General of the time, Margaret Chan, essentially lied about where she was because there's a lot of pressure to do something, say something. And she said that she was dealing with the worst public health crisis in generations or something, which most people took her to mean dealing with Ebola. In actual fact, she was talking about vaping with Putin in Moscow. So they've had a lot of bad luck. And this time, yeah, I mean, it looks probably like it is due to these protests. We might have seen on Twitter a guy in Panama shooting dead two environmentalists the other day. No, you didn't see that one? It's quite dramatic. A lot of people were saying it was just the oil, but it wasn't. It must have been these people who were protesting against a Canadian, as you say, a Canadian mining company has been sold. They're not being given the rights, they've been sold hundreds of millions of dollars a year. Been sold the rights to mine in what is apparently the biggest copper mine in the world in Panama, and the Panamanians are not happy about this. I'm not exactly sure why, but they think they're being exploited in some way. So they've been kicking off for a couple of weeks, and the Foreign Office is more or less telling people not to go. Not quite, but it is saying, you know, it could get quite dicey and it could escalate quite quickly. I was actually supposed to go. So I've now got a week free next week because there's an American think tank was going to do some events over there because you can't get into the conference. You know, even if you're a journalist, you can't get into the conference or you get kicked out on the first lunchtime every single time. It's like a shocking lack of transparency about what's going on in this thing. But we were going to just show up anyway and you know, I don't know, make some videos and stuff. So there's no point in me going there because there wasn't a lot of point in the first place, you could argue, because I can't get in the conference, but there's even less point now. There are also rumours that actually the WHO had copped this up and they didn't really have anyone to organise the thing properly, and so they were quite relieved to have the opportunity to cancel it. I don't know, but they are completely incompetent, so it's quite possible that they arrange this in 2 weeks before I realised they didn't have a hotel to hold it or whatever. Anyway, it's off. Which is actually quite a good thing for if you're a vapor in particular, because on the agenda this time, although it's supposed to be a tobacco conference, it's turned into an anti-vaping conference, really, and they're much more agitated by nicotine pouches and vapes and heated tobacco than they are about people smoking cigarettes, which are rather like much of the public health lobby these days. And it probably wouldn't have much effect on Britain because we're pretty self-governing, but what the WHO recommends does carry a certain amount of weight in large parts of the world, and what the WHO has been recommending recently has been essentially ban e-cigarettes, and if you can't ban them, regulate them into the dust. So the fact that this has been at least postponed for a few months is a good thing.
Certainly sounds like it. And at what point did the WHO become so anti-vaping? Has that just been something more or less since it first kicked off? Because it seems like they've been, from what you describe, kind of ahead of the curve in suggesting these things are dangerous than should be.
They've never been keen, but they've got more fanatical about it as the years have gone on. So initially, going back more than a decade ago, they clearly were wary about it, but they didn't say a lot about it. They didn't really try and do much about it. And actually, the last 3 or 4 years, they've got much more vocally opposed to it, to the point where, as I say, the conference is now essentially about that rather than about tobacco. It's very debatable whether the WHO actually has any real remit to look at this. I mean, the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control is a treaty. It's a global treaty. Most countries have signed it.
including the UK. The USA hasn't, but the UK and most countries have. But it is explicitly about tobacco, and e-cigarettes are not tobacco products. And so it's debatable whether they really have any jurisdiction over this, but anyway, they've decided that they do. And they are a huge force for evil in this area. They're massively funded by Mike Bloomberg, who's an even bigger force for evil. And, you know, I know this is a bit of a kind of who funds you thing, but it's, we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, and really have an effect over the WHO's output. They are putting out reports. They're essentially Mike Bloomberg front group reports. Yeah, he's a global ambassador for them and all this kind of stuff. The WHO, we've probably mentioned on a podcast once, gave an award to the Indian health minister because he banned e-cigarettes. You know, they are really keen on clamping down on safer nicotine products, which is obviously bad for liberty and also very bad for public health as it goes.
Alka, anything on the WHO and its vaping conference?
Well, I was just going to say, I had a look at their website, and what struck me about the FCTC is, I mean, just this one sentence, right? Just listen to it. The Convention Secretariat continues to support the parties to the WHO, FCTC, and the protocol to eliminate illicit trade in tobacco products, all in capital letters, with implementing their obligations under the treaties and to protect their present and future generations from the devastating health, social, environmental, and economic consequences of tobacco consumption and tobacco smoke. And you just think, yeah, this is, you know, what political pomposity and irrational overclaiming. I mean, to me, it's so indicative of these, you know, this kind of language indicates real kind of mythical forms of backwards thinking, really. I mean, what are the causal links between someone lighting up, emitting some smoke, and devastating social and environmental and economic consequences? I mean, it's utterly illogical. But the fact that these huge, you know, international, transnational bodies still exist, and not only do they exist in their original remit, but as you were saying, Chris, their mission creep continues apace, is quite extraordinary, I think. I mean, you've only got to look at the cursory look at the figures to see how untrue it is. And yet, so here we are in it's a real example of an official world that is entirely fantasy and has very little connection with the real world that most of us live in.
Yeah, there's one more thing to say about this, is that the reason that it's so hard to get into the conference is that they are paranoid beyond belief about the tobacco industry, right? Now, in my opinion, any UN conference, anybody should be able to go, right? It's taxpayer funded. If you go to the more famous COP conferences, the climate change ones, yeah, they do have BP there and Shell there and so on, and some of the activists don't like it very much, but the UN says, well, look, these people are, whether you like it or not, stakeholders. Whereas with the FCTC one, they've got some guidance here. Well, it's not even guidance, these are rules. I mean, I know an organization, for example, called the New Nicotine Alliance, which is a charity, it doesn't get any money from tobacco or vaping companies or anything like that. They applied to go to this conference and they were turned down just because they don't toe the party line, essentially. But their definition here of somebody with a financial or non-financial link to the tobacco industry, therefore might as well not bother trying to apply to this conference, is as follows, right? Interests refer to any financial or non-financial links with the tobacco industry, including through employment, consultancy, research, business, professional or personal interests, contributions or gifts, families or spouse/partners' interests, relationships up to the fourth degree of consanguinity and affinity. Fourth degree.
What even is that?
So, what's that like? You've been in a lift together once or something like?
Pretty much.
Good grief.
Absolutely hilarious. Whilst we're on the subject of tobacco control or nicotine control, what have you, Chris, another thing that you've written about over the course of the past week or so, is more and more questions, or at least a few more questions, starting to be asked of the government about their plan to usher in the prohibition of smoking via this escalator where the age will get higher by 1 year every year until smoking is effectively illegal in this country. You wrote about Labour MP Kevin Jones, who's asked the government a pretty simple and you would think obvious question about whether or not they'd had a think about whether or not this would fuel the black market as prohibition almost always does. Do you want to tell us what the response was and what you made of all of that?
Yes, a very obvious question, as you say. Even people who support this policy have their concerns about, you know, the black market being fueled by it. So, as you said, Kevin Jones asked the question, like, what assessment has the government made? This is to Neil O'Brien, who has since resigned. We'll maybe come on to him in a moment. But his response was firstly that no assessment has been made. Mm-hmm. So they haven't assessed the most obvious risk of this policy at all. And then he said, history shows whenever we introduce new tobacco control legislation and regulations, illicit tobacco has decreased due to strong enforcement. This is just not true. It's just not true. I mean, there's been more or less constant tobacco regulation and legislation under this government and indeed Labour before. And it's not like illicit tobacco has gone up and up and up necessarily, but it hasn't gone down and down and down by any means. And in fact, the last few years, it's been going up, even, you know, notwithstanding the fact that we don't really measure it very well. I suspect the black market is much bigger than HMRC wants to admit. So, you know, we're supposed to have such a thing as, you know, better regulation. There's supposed to be all these checks and balances for regulation these days to make sure policies are evidence-based. Mm-hmm. There is no evidence for this policy at all. People say, well, it's been tried in New Zealand. It hasn't come into effect in New Zealand, and it won't do for several years. And in New Zealand, the only evidence it was going to work was some modelling, and you'll know how useless that is if you're familiar with the sugar tax, minimum pricing, COVID, you know, any number of things. Public health modelling has not had a good few years. It's all, they're doing it, apparently, in the belief that every time they've clamped down on tobacco in the past, the black market's got smaller, which it obviously hasn't. And anyway, this isn't like just a bit more regulation. This is actually gradually prohibiting the sale of all tobacco, by the way, folks. If you're thinking this is just cigarettes, it's not. It's cigarette papers, it's cigars, it's heated tobacco, it's snuff. I mean, all the, you know, products that are really popular with young people.
You can't move for snuff amongst school kids.
Yeah, that's not just a little bit of regulation. And this is not banning smoking in cars with kids. This is not graphic warnings. You do not need to be, you know, an historian to know that prohibition is something that's going to lead to the black market. You could argue it's going to be worth it, I suppose, in some sense. You can say, well, or maybe, you know, maybe the black market won't be that massive, or maybe there won't be that much demand because so few people would be smoking. You can make all those arguments. I don't agree with any of them. You can make, but what you shouldn't be doing is just flat out lying to the public. And Neil O'Brien has, I feel a bit sorry for Neil O'Brien because he's obviously been told to say these things. He I don't know if he was aware of this policy of Sunak's before it came out. He didn't seem to know much about it at the Tory conference when it was announced. But this is the guy, he's kind of like a microcosm, really, of the failure of the Tory party over 13 years. So he was at Policy Exchange, sort of centre-right think tank for years, not a stupid man by any means, then gets a safe seat. He was MP for 5 years, then he becomes Minister for Public Health, and now he's resigned to spend more time with his family. And what is he actually going to have to look back on? The only achievement, really, he's had as a minister has been to nick a policy from the New Zealand Labour Party, a very stupid policy of that, and introduce it before the British Labour Party got the chance to. You know, going back to our fabulous live episode last time, Tom, I was talking about, you know, how I don't understand the Tories, how I think a lot of them in a few years when they're in their slippers having a cup of Ovaltine, they're going to think we really had a bit of an opportunity there not to just extend the, you know, the nanny state, the you know, the big state, big government, what have you. And we didn't. We just did what Labour would have done. And this is exactly what Labour would have done, as indeed many other policies. So you kind of wonder what the point of voting Conservative is, really. And people seem to realise that, judging by the polls. They've realised that if you're going to have a whole lot of Labour policies introduced, you might as well have them introduced by the Labour Party who actually believe in them. And would get on with it, I suppose, rather than pretending they don't really agree with it and then changing their minds and introducing it. It's all very depressing. See, I'm genuinely distressed. What am I going to need? No one ever does what I want just because I'm genuinely distressed. Maybe I need to moan about it more. I thought.
I think your emotional safety has been very compromised this past few.
Yeah, exactly. My psychological state is in a terrible, terrible way, as anyone who's seen me recently will know. So why can't the government start capitulating cranks like me instead of these other cranks?
No, exactly. Well, you know, at least Neil O'Brien got a good few months in where he was just raging against Julia Hartley Brewer for saying something that he didn't agree with on lockdown or whatever. Was that Neil O'Brien, was it? I know he's done other things.
That was Neil O'Brien, yeah. And James O'Brien,
probably. Yes, the two kind of COVID witchfinder generals, and they're probably related.
Yeah, and O'Brien from 1984.
Exactly. There's dots to connect here. Alka, what do you make of Sunak's... I mean, this has basically been talked up as his legacy, that he's going to ban smoking. I mean, what do you make of all that?
How sad is that? I mean, my goodness. I mean, well, obviously, it seems any policy that is based on an untruth or a lie is like not a good idea to start with, as Chris has just explained. But it does seem to me to fit in so well with this, you know, with something that we're used to seeing now, unfortunately, over many, many years, which is kind of, you know, this personal politics of behaviour and a kind of tightening of the circle of our personal freedoms. And, you know, often around these issues to do with our body, to do with health, whether it's smoking or giving your kids crisps or, you know, turkey Twizzlers or whatever, you know, often it comes at the bottom line of the people's proponents' argument is that we need to do this because of the NHS for some reason, you know, to sort of save the NHS. But, I mean, that just strikes me as so, again, another indication of the topsy-turvy times that we're in, because It's like they're saying we've got a health service, but we've got to be healthy. So you know who needs
so that
a
we don't
service?
Use it, yeah. So that we use it as little as possible.
That's right. I mean, we need a better health service for who we are, how we are, and you know the way we choose to live our personal lives as freely as possible. You know, it's not for us to make ourselves fit for our GP.
I've got the solution.
Oh, I about know what this is going to be.
Privatise the NHS.
There we go.
James, it is already, isn't it? I thought.
Exactly. I thought Donald Trump had bought it at the last election. I can't remember. But it gets away from it.
It was a dossier that proved it, wasn't it?
Yeah, beyond doubt. Should we squeeze some postbag questions in?
Yes, please.
From our listeners.
Postbag.
It's bulging, eh?
I want to start off here with one for Chris. Chris, I'm not sure how aware you are of advertising for alcohol in India, but this particular question addresses that. Does India's surrogate advertising of booze offer protection for us from future nanny state advertising bans? I'm in India for the World Cup, and on TV I keep seeing Johnny Walker quote glassware and similar adverts. So an attempt to get round the censors potentially here, Chris. What do you make of it?
I don't know anything about the advertising ban, but it sounds like they have an advertising ban and there's various loopholes in terms of merchandise. Is that the gist?
That seems to be the gist, yeah. I'm not 100% sure if that is the case, but
way forward is to legalise alcohol advertising, if indeed it was banned in India, which wouldn't surprise me. A lot of things are banned in India. It's good that Johnny Walker's been promoted because we need to sell more British booze and spirits in particular to India. That would be a big win from a trade deal if we can start selling more whiskey there. There's a lot of demand for Scotch whiskey in particular, you won't be surprised to hear, in India. And at the moment they have to drink horrible stuff. And in fact they have actual prohibition parts of India, to go back to the old prohibition thing. And Neil O'Brien would be surprised to hear that they've got quite a big black market in booze as a result. It's funny how it keeps happening again and again, doesn't it? So, yeah, not an expert about that particular issue. Wish I'd looked into it before we started recording. But if the question is, am I in favour of companies trying to get around stupid advertising bans? Yes, long may it continue.
And, Alka, we've got a question for you here about the school's indoctrination question. Why do, this is a question for someone called Choices Freedom, probably not their given name, but why do schools blindly teach and entrench racism, transgenderism, these kind of woke ideologies? Why are all the teaching staff on board with it, is the question here. So you talked a little bit about teacher training there, but why do you think that seemingly so many teachers are just, it's almost like the water they swim in now, without them even realizing it.
Yeah, no, I think it you know, that's it. You know, you've put your, it is the water that they swim in. It's the loss of any sense that, you know, education might mean something other than affirming a very shallow identity of your pupils, and the kind of therapeutic, an adoption of a therapeutic model of education, which aims to avoid kind of cognitive challenge or intellectual challenge and favours self-esteem and things like that. So various things are coming into it. But I honestly don't think most teachers are doing, if they're using these materials, I don't think they're doing it with the aim of doing what the activists are very clear, right? I spoke to one the other day. She was very clear. I said to her, you know, what you seem to be doing is pursuing your political agenda in the classroom. And she basically said that is what she was doing, because because politics is too slow, you know, somehow, you know, so politics is just full of, you know, the implication is that politics is full of, you know, sub-satisfactory people, i.e. the demos. So when it takes a long time and they won't agree with you and they'll challenge you or not, you know, validate your lived experience. So let's do it in the classrooms instead, where you have a captive audience. So the activists certainly are doing that, but they've won the moral discourse in wider society, not amongst the public, but in the institutions and in civic society. And that's what makes it so difficult for most ordinary teachers to stand up to it. That, combined with the fact that, you know, you've had a decimation of teacher education, you know, where they've got no intellectual training to even think through these ideas properly, because, you know, it's just been, they've been made into, conceived as being technical deliverers of the curriculum rather than sources of intellectual and ethical authority.
Do you think, though, that forcing kids to learn this stuff at school is quite a good way of turning kids against you? Because kids don't like school, do they?
They might. I mean, you know, that's true. Certainly some of the young people I speak to, and occasionally when I do outreach sessions, most young people are not lapping this up uncritically. But I think what it does do, which I think is harmful, is facilitate a kind of general cynicism. And I think it kind of, it means that, they might not adhere to that specific woke ideology, but there's a real kind of shallow, superficial idea of what politics is about, where it becomes very confused with, like, your immediate emotional responses and the idea that you might want to park your immediate responses and talk about, you know, just sort of calm down and think about a wider circle of interests is something that we're not bringing children up to do, really. We're not familiarising them with that. And that's a much wider cultural problem.
And also, just especially when what you're talking about there before, Alka, about very young children, just introducing the idea of race and insisting that this is something that divides up these children, that it sets them against each other from such a young age. It's like the complete inverse of what people used to say, that isn't it nice that kids don't have all of these kind of hang-ups?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's cruel, Tom. It's really, really cruel. The few instances that we have had, you know, with direct examples, and I mean, you've only got to think back to that dreadful programme, the school that tried to end racism, the Channel 4 programme, and you see this time and time again. Advocates of this ideology are so certain of their moral rightness and being on the right side of history that they literally see young children's discomfort and pain as a sign of goodness, right?
Progress.
that moral virtue, yeah. And that's what you see happening. You know, I had a teacher who was telling me they had to, after one of these companies had been in to visit and do some training with them, they then had to split their classes up into racial affinity groups to go off for the lesson. And she was just mortified when one of her pupils said, "Miss, why is my white friend not coming into this class with me?" And she didn't have an answer, you know. So teachers are being put in this position of having to pursue a practice which they themselves don't believe in. And there's very little space or encouragement to question it. Mm-hmm.
And before we let you go, Alka, we always ask our guests one final question, because this is a quite libertarian anti-ban podcast. If you did have to have one ban, what would it be? And it's got to be something really kind of petty and personal. It can't be banning indoctrination in schools or anything like that. To give you a flavour, I think last time around our live podcast, we had someone wanting to ban Americans from the London Underground. And I can't remember what else was. Chris's go-to example is wheelie suitcases, which he also objects to for some confusing reason, particularly on the London Underground. But so it's got to be something, yeah, very kind of, yeah, petty and personal rather than anything too worthy or serious.
Well, I guess it would be the following, perhaps, in this very particular tone. Well, I can't really say, it's complicated. I think I would ban that phrase in that tone if I could.
Yeah. Wheeled out a lot these days, definitely. Great. Alka, Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.